welcome to Writer's Blockbusters, the show where we treat the final edit of the movie like the script. I'm one of your hosts, Bob Rose, at Thundergrunt Bob on all relevant social medias. And right now, Jamie is going to introduce himself.
I'm Jamie Nash. I am the writer of Save the Cat Writes for TV and the Save the Cat Beat Sheet Workbook. And I'm also a screenwriter as well of a bunch of different things. IMDb me. Or you could check me out at on Twitter at Jamie underscore Nash. I'm completely after today only saying Twitter. That's my bow.
Okay, and now Jimmy's going to introduce himself.
I am Jimmy George. I am also a screenwriter and a script consultant, and my Twitter handle is at Jimmy R. George.
Awesome. And today we're going to talk, this is Jamie's pick, I believe. We're going to talk about the original 1976 classic, The Bad News Bears. Before we get into our discussion topics, we're going to go around and just say our relationship or thoughts on the movie. Let's start with the man himself who chose it, Jamie.
Yeah. So The Bad News Bears was 1976. It was my first all-time favorite movie, which only lasted to 1977 when Star Wars came out.
But, that's such an unfair comparison. Yeah.
But still, it was kind of a game changer. It was the first movie I can remember being my favorite movie. Like, I saw it when I was a very little kid. I was like four, I guess. I was about 4 years old when I first saw this, or five. But I remember seeing it multiple times, and I also saw all the sequels. And as Jimmy once said on this podcast, pre-Star Wars, to me, we were coming out of like my dad's era, which was all about baseball. Like, I collected baseball cards. I watched baseball. There was this goofy show called The Baseball Bunch on with Johnny Bench, which I loved. That was in the 80s, though. But baseball was everything. And this particular movie hit. I don't even know that I started Little League for a couple years after. But the memories of this combined with Little League, very similar. The people, very realistic movie. I mean, the realism of this movie is strangely off the charts when I rewatch it. This movie really captures an era in a way that family movies don't even try to do anymore. You know, this is a very, it feels like a movie made for adults that's for kids. And I know there's some things that aren't for kids, but it feels like a movie made for adults, really. And I think when I was a kid, I gravitated toward that. I hated, in fact, when the 80s came, it was a hard transition for me. Like I know Bob loves like the 90s movies and the kids movies and that era and stuff like that. For me, The Bad News Bears was a kid's movie. And when I saw those other movies that were kind of artificial and safe and all this stuff, I had a really hard time with them. Because The Bad News Bears was about as kid movie as I ever could get. So if you showed me something else in this era, I'd be like, it doesn't feel real to me. You know, even as 4 and 5 year old, this is the kind of movie I wanted as a kid that grew up in the 70s. So when the 80s and 90s came, it felt weird. It was like, oh, they make these movies that are like kind of like stylized, and then they're different. They're geared in a different sort of way. So anyway, Bad News Bears, one of my favorite movies for many, many, many years until the 80s came and gave me one favorite movie a week, and probably buried it a little bit. But I still love it. And on rewatch, I see why. It really is a quality kind of movie. Even now, kind of independent in a weird sort of way, as like a weird independent documentary vibe almost. And sometimes that's what I got for you.
Cool. Jimmy.
This was a first time watch for me.
So whoa! That's first.
I know we don't get those very often on the show. So I will say, as Jamie mentioned about the baseball reference in other, cause we've done one other baseball movie.
League of Their Own.
League of Their Own. Yeah. And so I think I got to say this before, but like baseball was, when I was a kid, baseball was my life. I played 80 games a summer, my 14-year-old, 15-year-old, 16-year-old, and 17-year-old summers. I played 80 games a summer. I played fall ball. I played in high school. I got accepted into a college to play baseball that I decided not to do. So it was probably like my first love, you know, craft love, before screenwriting, you know? So I don't know how I have never seen this movie. That being said, but my favorite thing about the movie speaks to what Jamie said, which is the authenticity. And Jamie, some of the stuff you brought up, oddly, is like, when we get to it on the talking points for me, I think it's basically we're just going to say exactly what you said about how it compares to the other kids' movies that came out in the 80s and the 90s, that authenticity. Just you can tell that the people who made this movie like spent a lot of time on Little League fields with all the drama between the kids and the parents and the coaches and just all the little things. I experienced that in the 80s and 90s of playing baseball. Like every single thing that happened besides the coach giving me beer,
right?
You know, after we win a game.
So that happened to me in basketball when I was in the coach used to give us beer and stuff like us. I remember one time, I mean, this is so weird. One time, and it was really like read the room kind of thing. It was really off tone. But he'd come in and like bring, this is so weird that I'm going to say what I'm about to say. I remember one time he tried to motivate us by bringing a Playboy magazine in. And we were like, what the hell is this guy doing?
Yeah.
But he was trying to be cool. And like we kind of all looked at each other like, this guy really thinks, what is this guy thinking, you know? But anyway, there were some weird ass coaches and stuff.
Oh, yeah, no, and I definitely experienced
coaches
around a bunch of little kids who were, like, straight up drinking right in front of you, like, out in the open, like, with no regard or concern. Like, it was so normalized.
The one thing...
all adults used to drink at my childhood, right? Like, that was so...
it was just beers in everyone's hand.
Everyone was drinking constantly.
The one thing that you remind me, like, it almost comes off as comedy now, but, like, when they're all driving in his car and they're all, like, sitting in the back, like, that's not even a comedic moment for me in 1976.
That was just normal.
That wasn't supposed to be the joke. Like, it's probably like if you did that in a movie now, it's like the joke is like, oh my God, look how reckless they were in 76. But honestly, that wasn't even a joke. It was right, there's so many things in this that really aren't jokes. They're just realism. And there are a lot of things that are jokes as well. But the one thing, Jimmy, that you reminded me of to mention was in the 80s, by the time you get to the 80s or 90s, I'd say, the 90s, if you do Bad News Bears, it's mostly about how into it the parents are, right? Like how, like, my kid's not playing and my kid should be playing. So back then, and this is true to my life, parents didn't give a crap. They sent you there. They didn't even show up in the stands. Like, they have some people there in the stands, but they didn't really care. And, like, you know,
they wanted you out of the house.
Right. You know, in the beginning where they said nobody would coach, so we had to hire a guy. So that's not true at all anymore. Like, now they're almost fighting each other to coach the team. But kind of that part of it was, it's different. Like, when I watched it, I was like, this is different than what they make now. Cause now it'd be about how helicopter parents or whatever are involved. And back then there usually was one parent who was kind
of a parent,
jerk.
The asshole. Yeah.
It was one asshole that was kind of the jerk. But the rest of the parents were kind of like hands off and like, whatever you got is fine. Yeah.
I had a parent that was not my parent who would like, I played outfield and he would sit on the outfield fence right behind me and like heckle me. Like I was like 12 years old and he'd be like, you got to stand on the balls of your feet. Come on. Like, why didn't you get that? And
he was probably drinking too.
I wasn't very good at baseball. I played for many years, but you get the one parent, like I'd come up to bat and it'd be like, okay, automatic out. He don't want to hit. He's going to strike out. It's like, I'm 9 years old. I'm scared. Yeah. I don't want to get hit by the ball. This guy's
adult tackling me. So anyway, Bob, back to, you know, what the movie means to me. It's just baseball was such a huge part of my life. And I appreciate the level of authenticity, even though Ida wasn't alive in the 70s. I was, you know, playing Little League in the late 80s and early 90s. So,
yeah. Gotcha. I wanted to say two things. Kind of a response to what Jamie said. The artifice of I love the artifice of the 90s and everything. Like, I know it's not like this movie.
Right.
And I
right.
think that's part of the reason I find it so funny. Like, studio mandated artifice has always been one of the reasons I love movies. Mm-hmm. You know, like the actual how fake it is, you know, like Surf Ninjas or something like that. Right. Like, it's obviously made by a boardroom. Anyway, this movie is like the Rosetta Stone of sports movies, right? Like, it is the John Carter of Mars of sports movies, right? Like, even you're talking about the authenticity of like him drinking and the kids cursing and all everyone being terrible, but as far as like sports movies and structure and everything goes, like, this is the thing that crawled out of the primordial ooze to create all the movies that I grew up with, right? Like, right, we've done Mighty Ducks on this podcast.
Right, right.
Yeah, I mean, like, Mighty Ducks. There is no Mighty Ducks without the Bad News Bears.
Yeah, it's right? kind of amazing watching this. How it was like it created, like you said, the template that all.
Yeah, it's the, yeah. They don't exist without the Bad News Bears. Like, there's so many movies I can name, and I'm not going to bore. Yeah,
even like School of Rock, which isn't.
Yeah,
even,
no.
You
know. Yeah, it doesn't need to be sports movies. Just Bad News Bears created it.
Different paint. On the Bad News Bears, and you have endless movies that we love,
and they were so huge in especially my childhood. Probably more Jimmy's, not so much Jamie's, mm-hmm. but yeah. like everything we love, Jimmy mm-hmm. came from the structure and the bones and the DNA of Bad News Bears. They just Disney-fied it, and they removed the drinking and the cursing, mm-hmm. but the structure. And the moments.
Yeah, you might even be able to argue there's some Monster Squad DNA in there, too.
You could. You probably could. Yes, you probably could. It's just watch. I haven't seen this since maybe like the late 90s. I'll be honest. I haven't rewatched it in forever. I've probably seen the remake sooner than I have seen this.
I wrote a script and rewatched it because I was writing a Bad News Bears-esque script at one point.
Right.
And I think I rewatched it. But I'm kind of in your boat.
What do you mean?
I hadn't watched it in a while.
Okay. You know, yeah. And it just like dawns on you how it started so much shit that you're used to. That was so incredibly important to my life. It's the grandfather of all that stuff. And second, I just wanted to say, just because Michael Ritchie, the director, he's made so many movies I love. Right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't think we haven't done any of his other movies. And if we ever did, I'd love to do Fletch.
Yeah.
But he's done like The Golden Child, and he wrote Cool Runnings, and he directed another one of my favorite baseball movies, which is The Scout. And if you've ever seen The Scout, mm-hmm. as far as authenticity goes, The Scout is pretty wild as far as, you know, a comedy is concerned. I wanted to mention Michael Ritchie, and we should revisit him sometime.
We should.
I would love to do Flesh on the show, but yeah. Just a great comedy director, and just a great director. So
I'm down for Fletch.
But that's all I really had to say. I love Bad News Bears, and I'm a huge Walter Matthau fan. Not just because of Dennis the Menace. That's the first thing I ever saw with Matthau. But I always went back and I watched all of his 70s movies and stuff. Well, what do you know? I was born in 82.
No,
what
I know.
Want? Yeah, no, what
I,
do no, you want?
I knew him for this and Grumpy. I mean, for
Grumpy Dennis Old Men.
Grumpy Old Men. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Two bangers right there. That whole franchise.
So why don't I set 1976 and then we'll talk about who wrote it?
Yeah. Yeah.
So 1976. So a year before Star Wars, a year after Jaws. Am I getting that right? 75. Is that right? I think so.
That sounds right.
That sounds right. Sounds I could look right. it up.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Because Jaws either came out in 75 or 76, but I'm pretty sure it's 75. It's not on this list, so it must be 75.
I will look it up.
So the number one movie of 1976 was one we already did. What
Jaws
is
Jaws of 75.
Yeah.
The Exorcist? Halloween?
No. No, I'm quizzing you. Rocky. Rocky.
Rocky. Oh, Rocky. Dude, yeah, this yeah. and Rocky in the same year? Yep. Wow.
And the filming style is very similar, yeah. too, it is. Right? It feels so similar.
It feels very like...
real.
It feels documentary style. Like, there's not a lot of lights being set up in the corner and reflectors and stuff like that. It feels like just kind of classic.
In a way, Walter Matthau is like Mick, mm-hmm. sort of at a different point in his life, maybe.
So the number two movie, which we discussed when Rocky came out, was To Fly, an IMAX film. That was the number two movie listed here.
Okay.
Yeah. And we talked about that in the Rocky because I was shocked. I was like, really? That thing? That thing stayed in the theaters for like the next 10 years at IMAX because it was like the only IMAX movie they'd ever show. A Star is Born is 3. Mm-hmm. A huge movie. This is like my second, this is probably the movie, my favorite movie before the Bad News Bears or right after it, or they were the top two. The 1976 King Kong looms large in my personal, it's probably the first scary movie I saw in the theater. So that was a huge one for me. Silver Streak. I didn't see any of the rest of these, to be honest. Silver Streak in the theater. I saw many years. All the President's Men, which I've seen a million times since. The Omen, which I've seen a million times since. The Enforcer, which I don't know what that is. I'd have to look that up.
Dude, it's Clint Eastwood.
That's what I was going to say.
Dirty Harry.
Is that a Dirty Harry movie? I was going to say, I think it's a Dirty, but I was thinking
I'm
like.
I'm a big Dirty Harry fan, so.
So, I know. So what was the order? Dirty Harry, because I thought Magnum Force came. Was that third after the
Enforcer? Hold on. Now you're confusing me.
I don't know. I thought.
I love how much Jamie loves this list.
Well, the weird thing about The Enforcer was I thought it was a Dirty Harry movie, but I honestly don't remember it. And I saw Magnum Force. I saw, what's the one, go ahead, make my day, which came in the 80s.
Magnum Force is the second one. The Enforcer is the third. Oh. Sudden Impact, and then The Deadpool. The Deadpool.
Yeah. Yeah. Sudden Impact. Yeah, and I love Ryan Reynolds in that last one.
Actually, you remember who cameoed in The Deadpool? It's Jim Carrey.
Jim Carrey. Welcome to the Jungle. The first
well,
time
he sings Welcome to the Jungle,
first
right.
time I ever heard Guns N' Roses. Yeah. So weird when you go back and look at it now because it feels comedic, but at the time it didn't strike me.
It's like a tragic scene, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny with The Enforcer. Anyway, I'll have to go back and check that one out. I'm sure I saw it because I love the Dirty Harry movies.
Honestly, they're all great except for The Deadpool, but yeah, The Deadpool's fine.
Okay. So Midway was number 9. Then Bad News Bears is 10.
Okay.
Bad News Bears at 42 million domestic. I think this is all domestic. And
what was the budget?
It was, I think, 9.
Okay.
A different era, back then.
But for 76, 9 million is kind
of that's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money, right? Yeah.
Spend right. On kids movie.
Rocky made
a kids.
Just as a comparison, Rocky made 117 million. To Fly made 86. But then the other ones are down the 60s, 50s, 40s category. So that's kind of where normal movies made money was 40, 50, 60. And then the huge blockbusters like Rocky or Jaws or something, if they scratched out six figures, that was incredible. And it's funny because all the movies after this were more the movies I saw in the theater. Is Bad News Bears, Silent Movie came out. I didn't see that in the theater, but I saw it a lot. The Pink Panther Strikes Again, another one huge from my childhood. Murder by Death, another one huge for my childhood.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And looms large in a lot of the stuff I write these days. And then Marathon Man, Taxi Driver, Outlaw, Josie Wales, Carrie. This is one that popped to me. Logan's Run, I remember as a made for TV movie. So now I got to go Wikipedia that because I always thought that only appeared on TV. I had no idea it appeared in the theater.
I knew that was theatrical.
Yeah. So when I first saw that, that was on television. So it must have come out very soon after its theatrical run. Network and Across the Great Divide. That's your top 20. So the writer of The Bad News Bears is one of the most interesting, I bring this writer up all the time because people ask me a certain question that will come apparent in 2 seconds. So he's written basically he's written more than two things. He wrote all the sequels to Bad News Bears. So the Bad News Bears, and I'm trying to do this by memory now. I should look it up. The Bad News Bears and Breaking Training. Bad News Bears Go to Japan or something like that. Mm-hmm. Or was that Breaking Training? Which I saw all these in the theater. And then his next movie was The Thing. And that's Bill Lancaster. And that's really all his movies.
Which we need to do. We're going to do it someday.
We're going to do The Thing, but that is such an awesome...
Yeah.
That is such an awesome career.
Yeah, so,
Bad News Bears franchise and the thing.
And that's it.
Done! Then you just die happy.
Yeah,
you're
done.
Nothing. You got nothing left.
He's the son of Burt Lancaster.
That's awesome.
And so when whenever I'm on it, because basically my credits are horror and kids movies, people ask me this all the time. And I bring up Bill Lancaster all the time. I'm saying, yeah, I was like, Bill Lancaster. He did. And a lot of times the you know, the young reps and stuff that I'm talking to or the young executive, they have no idea. They're like, oh, what? Bad News Bears in the Thing? You know, it's like this shocking kind of revelation to them. But for that reason, he's always been one of my personal favorite screenwriters.
He's your Savage Steve Holland, Jamie.
He's my Savage Steve Holland. Exactly.
He's done just like a few things that you love dearly.
It's
interesting because The Thing came after the Bad News Bears.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
That was like, so that, you know, I've shared that example, Jamie, of the character descriptions on the front page.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And Bad News Bears does not, it's like, traditional, like the character descriptions come when the characters are described. I just looked at the script today. One of my classic examples I give to clients for great character descriptions is from the first page of The Thing, which is basically just is like a cast list and a description of each cast member.
It was funny because a lot of times new screenwriters with me, forget the description part. For some reason, that used to be the thing that got me excited because I thought I could get playful and economic. And it was always a chance to kind of shine a light on myself a little bit. Like, look at me. Look how smart
your
I
voice.
Am. You know? Yeah. And I've noticed that a lot of new screenwriters completely, they just put Joe walks. And I'm like, is Joe a kid? Yeah. Is Joe, what is Joe?
No visuals, as I've preached about the action figure exercise, like what does Joe look like? Like I go the entire script. I don't even know if Joe is tall.
Is he a human?
Is he an old alien? Man? Is he an old man? Is he a baby? You know, right. There's all kinds of things. So I sent recently because of that. I sent somebody I saw your thing that you tweeted the thing, and I sent that to somebody. They took all the wrong thing from that. They were like, oh, I can put on my first page all these descriptions and make I'm like, I'll never send that list again. They were so excited that that's what they could do. They were like, oh, okay, that's great. I'll just make a list, like a casting breakdown on my first page. And I was like, no, don't do that. So anyway,
well, that was who wrote this shit.
That's who wrote this.
I never asked the question. I realized that. No bingo for you. okay, keeping it on the field and how it affects Act One structure.
So the one amazing thing about this movie, and another thing when you compare it to the 90s stylized movies, and most of the movies I'll preach about, keep in mind, Save the Cat, Blake Snyder was a 90s writer. I mean, that's what Blank Check and things like that. Like a lot of the movies he talks about, Legally Blonde, for example. I'm not sure was that in the 90s or was that 2000s?
That was awesome.
But it feels like a 90s movie, right?
We've done it on the show, Jamie.
Yeah. In the 90s.
Exactly. Or like Liar Liar, which was a 90s movie. Things like that. You know, he was very 90s stylized, you know, that kind of kids, those weren't kids movies, but those kind of movies were prevalent in the 90s.
It's also when the business became what it became in his era, you know, like that's why he was born from that.
It was the spec era where screenwriters were selling specs for, you know, bidding wars and things like that. Off
remember
a high
that?
Concept.
Never happened to me.
I came in after that.
Me too.
Yeah. I came in a few years after. So this movie doesn't really do, you know, in Blake's homework and play, that's the big thing, The Ordinary World. This thing is just, whether you consider the baseball the work or the play, that's all it is, really. It doesn't really do homework and play. It doesn't, like, if this movie were made in the 90s, we would see Buttermaker at home, and he's got a crappy house, and his girlfriend hates him, and he's about to get evicted. And then he goes to work and everybody kind of craps on him and the kids, we'd see their parents and we'd see him in school. The kids would be in school.
I mean, use Gordon Bombay, all the stuff we know about Gordon Bombay, right?
Yeah.
And Charlie and Charlie's mom. And
Charlie's mom. I mean, we've done Mighty Ducks, so I feel like that's the perfect
contrast 70s. Between perfect. The takes on the material.
It would almost be worth doing this as a double, you know, a kind
we
of
did it podcast. Already,
yeah, I know. I'm not saying, let's just throw let's what we again. Have to the wall. Now that we know everything about it. But it really is interesting in comparison. This movie, and again, I think it sticks to that documentary feel of the movie. It's like we're gonna stick to the baseball team, and even the things that happen outside of the baseball team, maybe with the exception of when he recruits Amanda, like that's about it. You know, that's about the only time he really moves away. But everything else,
and that's like the extent of his personal life.
That's the home, right?
That's home for this movie, but it's small.
Yeah.
It's enough. I think it's sufficient. You get everything you need from it.
I'd be hard pressed to find another movie like this in the last 20 years that didn't go three dimensions, you know, didn't go homework and play in this genre, maybe like an action movie or a horror thriller or something that just like he wakes up in the coffin and he's stuck, you know, Ryan Reynolds wakes up in the coffin and he's stuck or something.
Jamie, I haven't. Ryan Reynolds, I'm gonna rewatch it because of this episode. But Jamie, did the remake go into his home? Did the Billy Bob Thornton go to his home?
I was wondering the same thing. I think it did.
I'm actually gonna rewatch it. I meant to before this because I wanted to actually talk about differences, but I didn't do it.
And I think the remake actually kept it real in some ways. It tried to, you know, replicate the things that worked in this movie. Like it didn't, and it basically
there's
kept
so
the
much,
same structure and stuff.
There's so much Bad News Bears and Bad Santa that it makes so much sense to have him be this character, you know?
By the way, something I meant to mention was, and this kind of goes a little bit, but it related to that. I read something where Quentin Tarantino lists this as his number 12 favorite movie.
Of all time.
Yeah. And I was trying to find out what he thought about it, like the specifics of it, because he's always got a take and interesting things to say. I couldn't find it. I didn't dig deep enough. I started Googling this morning and all I could find was everybody's list. Like one surprising movie is the Bad News Bears, or something like that.
I found something where he also defended the sequels. He likes Tarantino is a fan of the sequels. They're not on the list, but he's a fan of them.
As a kid, especially the first sequel, I was a big fan of the first sequel. I don't know. There's a lot of things I liked about the first sequel, and I still remember it fondly. I don't even remember the third sequel. I tried watching it not too long ago.
There's also a TV show.
Yeah, or the third movie. And the TV show, I remember watching the TV show, but by then the magic was kind of gone, and it just was like... I remember they got some of the cast back or something, or I don't know. It wasn't great. But so keep it on the field. So I was amazed at how focused this movie was, unlike my current answer to this question, just about the keeping it on the field. And but one of the things I will say it did was I started to try to think of the catalyst of this movie. And the way I break it down is the catalyst it's kind of strange because normally in this movie, what would happen, like if I was writing Mighty Ducks, right? The catalyst would be you have to coach a hockey team. Which happens after you introduce the ordinary world of the hero. So you're getting him to the upside down world of being a coach of a kid's team. So you spend 10 minutes of ordinary world before the catalyst comes, you have to coach a team. And this one, literally from the opening scene, it's like, here's your check. You're coaching a team. He's in an upside down world for him in some ways. He's never coached a kid's team.
He is.
But so the way I restructured it in my head is it's like when the kids take that first loss is the catalyst because it triggers an emotional change.
Right.
At first it's all fun and we're just going to goof off. But then when they get beat so bad, it's like, oh, we're actually playing. This isn't just, you know, hitting the ball around the field. And it triggers things like the kids' embarrassment. Should they try? Should they quit the league? That's the debate section. And then the break into is kind of like, let's try to win some games.
Let's actually try.
Let's actually try. Let's try to win. So it does have a three-act structure. It's just, it's harder to see it in some ways because of this. Keep
Could you argue the catalyst for the kids and for Buttermaker are almost separated? Like Buttermaker's catalyst is later on, you know, when he starts caring. Like he has
that conversation with Amanda where she basically is like, you're an asshole. And then he comes the next day to the field and he's like, yeah, maybe I should try a little harder. Yeah, you're right. Like
it's like there's two different catalysts of the kids and him. Yeah.
Which is also very not like the movies we watched today.
Right. Yeah. They all have the let's do it moment. Instead, right. Yeah.
After that, it settles into, and I'll skip to the next topic a little bit. It settles into a kind of a common golden fleece, which I'll explain, structure. It has a midpoint. It has the fun and games with the kids trying and playing multiple games and things like that and getting better. And it almost like a heist movie in some ways where he's figuring out things like recruiting the bad kid on the motorcycle and getting Amanda to be the pitcher and things like that. He's kind of figuring things out along the way. And that's kind of the fun and games of it all is like kind of that road trip, which is common in Golden Fleece. So a Golden Fleece is a save the cat term. This is the thing that I get stuck talking about repeating the most, which is the save the cat genres. The save the cat genres are story patterns as opposed to like audience expectations, like common genres, like you'd see back in the days of Blockbuster, like horror, comedy, stuff like that, were the old kind of, not the old genres, but the most common term genre uses. But Save the Cat genres, which I still hate that he called it that, are patterns. They're kind of patterns of stories. It's like saying the 10 story types. Would have been better if he just said the 10 story types, but instead he called them genre. Just to make my life miserable, that's why I did it. So one of them is Golden Fleece. Others we've talked about in the past, Monster in the House, Buddy Love, Institutionalized, Rite of Passage. This one is a Golden Fleece. And Golden Fleece, much like Rocky, much like Mighty Ducks, it falls into the Golden Fleece category. But also heist movies fall into Golden Fleece. Quest movies like Lord of the Rings or Fellowship of the Ring in some ways fall into Golden Fleece. And usually their elements come down to a trophy or a prize that somebody seeks, so the championship or something like that. In this case, it's kind of like, I don't know that they expect to win the championship. I think it's more like, I think they want to beat the Yankees is the thing.
Yeah,
they
want
to play against the Yankees.
Or they just want to keep their dignity.
That's kind of it. Like the ultimate thing. Like they'd be happy just to break even in some ways, I feel.
Yeah, yeah.
But their stated goal is to win as many games as possible and possibly beat the Yankees at the end of the season. A team is the other element of it. So usually there's a team of people that and last but not least or most important is a road. And the road is it could be a physical road, like the Yellow Brick Road in The Wizard of Oz, like that's a Golden Fleece. Or in the movie, The Road is kind of a Golden Fleece. Or it could be time or kind of a process, a journey or a season, like in sports movies. In a lot of sports movies, it is the season. So League of Their Own and things like that have this road that is the season that they have to navigate. And this movie classically falls into that pattern for sure. I think it's definitely a Golden Fleece, and I think it has all of the elements of a Golden Fleece.
Maybe one of the OG Golden Fleece movies.
OG, what's that?
the original
Golden Fleece movies. Yeah. Well, obviously there was other genres before, but as far as sports movies goes, I'd say arguably, you know, there's other sports movies before this, but this
there's tons of them, like Pride of the Yankees, and you know, there's football movies, and there's all kinds of things.
Slapshot and stuff, right?
Slapshot. There's even in recent The Longest Yard was around this time. There, you know, there.
I still feel like the movies that we grew up with, Jimmy specifically, yeah, were reaching for Bad News Bears.
I agree.
Out of all those other ones,
I think they were either.
There's even movies in the 90s that played the Bad News Bears music.
Yeah,
at times, like, you know what I mean. Like,
that's
like,
why it's so familiar.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, is this?
Yeah,
oh,
yeah.
Okay.
I think that's where that comes from.
Well, the funny thing is, I think most of the movies that we look back on probably are Rocky and Bad News Bears in some ways influenced. You know, as far as
As
far as sports movies go.
Well, that goes right into Common Sports Beats Subverted.
Yeah, so
whose is this?
So this is mine. This is mine. I feel like there are certain common sports beats that we see all the time, but the interesting thing about this movie, and this is why I say, if we went back and did the history of sports movies, there's probably a million of them that came in the, you know, 40s, 50s, 60s. You know, because whether it's wrestling, boxing, whatever, there's just tons of movies that came, because this movie has all the beats that we see now, but it. Almost at every turn, it subverts the moment. You know what I mean? It does something. It undercuts it. So here are a couple of the ones I particularly noted. Maybe there's even more along the way. I'm sure there is, but these are just three of the ones I noticed. So in almost all sports movies now, and all these kind of underdog stories, there's kind of that big speech moment, right, where somebody gives the big speech and then they go out and win. And this movie has one of my favorite scenes of all time. And when I rewatched it, it was even, I think I like it even more than I did years ago. And it's the one where he takes them in. It's the one after the one kid wouldn't get up there and get hit by the pitch.
He would step into it. Yeah.
And he gets them all back there in the locker room and he starts to give them the tough love speech, like, what are you, a bunch of jerks, you know, throwing, you know, he's getting mad at him and he's kind of trying to fire him up. And then he stops and there's like 30 seconds of silence where he just kind of looks at him, and they show clips of these little kids like staring back at him. And he realizes they're just little kids. And it's like, in my opinion,
he doesn't verbalize it at all. It's just all internal. Yeah.
In my opinion, one of the great, great scenes of all time. Like, honestly, I'll put that scene up against so many scenes. That scene, just watch the YouTube of just that scene or something. But it's kind of the big speech. He goes into the big speech and they realize these are just kids. And he kind of arcs at that moment and just sends them back to have fun. And it's an amazing moment to me where it subverts like the usual, like, you're a bum, you never are, you know. And instead, right when he's in the middle of that speech, he arcs. And he just is like, you know what, just go out there and have fun. And it's kind of the message of the movie.
I think in the 90s or the aughts or now, it would have all been verbalized too.
It would have.
Somebody been like, look at yourself. And then he'd be like, oh, I'm sorry, everyone. He doesn't say he's sorry.
Yeah.
He just...
No,
but he realizes
but
what
we
he did.
Feel it, and that's
we
all
we feel
mean.
It. We know he's sorry, and his apology is how he handles the rest of the game.
Yeah,
I feel like in League of Their Own probably has a version of this. I don't remember it well enough.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I feel like the big speech would have incorporated what they learned. You know what I mean? It would have been the actual big speech, but instead it would be saying the bad example is like, it doesn't matter win or lose as long as we, you know,
have fun. As
have
long as
fun,
you're fun
and we get out there and we will win. We'll be winners regardless. And, you know, and they'll go, rah, yeah. But instead, this one, he never really even gets to that point. He never really inspires them. He just stops and says, just go out there and play. You know, it's just like he completely stops and sends him out to play. It's one of my favorite scenes. Like, I just think that scene's kind of amazing, and it kind of shows you like the way it used to be done back in the day, as opposed, which was
do you think in the script how in the script it was enacted, you know, like did it say what was going through his head? Or because I mean, it is just silence. I'd have to look that up, but
I bet it doesn't. I bet he brought the silence to it to an extent. But in some ways, they had to shoot those inserts of all the faces and all that kind of stuff of all the kids. Well constructed. I bet you in the script it just kind of stops short and he stops and he probably sends them out. Maybe a little bit, maybe a line of reflection.
It's one of those things where it's like the casting also makes it work. Like Mathal has one of the most expressive faces in cinema history. So like you, not many actors can do that moment, you know.
It does right. All the work.
Yeah, it does so much work. You don't need anything else.
Yeah. So also another beat, the victory, the surprise victory, like the underdog victory. But in this case, much like Rocky, they lose. They don't win. So again, it's kind of subverted. Now, that's almost become its own cliche, is that in some ways.
It's the Rocky cliche almost, right?
It is. And these two movies came out the same year and did the same thing. So there are probably a lot of disappointed people in movies that year. We're like,
they didn't win?
Everybody loses. I still see some criticism to this day about like, that's an unsatisfactory ending to some people, like, you know, but it's the realism ending.
But the victory is them telling them to go fuck off.
Well, right. maybe I'll just bring in my topic here because this is like one of my big topics that I wanted to talk about.
Go for it.
The power of failure, which is, you know, I read a lot of scripts, whether it be sports or just, you know, you name the genre where, people succeed in the end, the character succeeds in achieving their goal, and based on the story that's happening, it doesn't feel right. Like, it's like people are so married to, like, they have to achieve the goal in the end and they have to win or else none of it matters. And I feel like, just like Rocky, this movie is better for them losing because it's authentic, right? And I think there's, like, what you could learn from this is, like, if them losing feels like the actual outcome that would happen, then that's the outcome that you should do. You know what I mean? Whatever is the most authentic. They made all the right choices, right? They grew, but they still couldn't overcome the obstacles. They're just not that good.
Also, the building blocks of them getting to the end, the movie's showing that they only got there from a series of mishaps that weren't even there. Forfeiting. The other coach made his foul up with the pitcher. You know what I mean? Like, they would have never even got that close.
Like, it was to the point that when I was watching, I was like, how the hell are they going to make me buy that they're going to win this?
Yeah.
Like, I was waiting for some goofy, over the top situation.
Because they're not that good.
Winning. I was waiting for that. And then it didn't come. They lost. And I was like, oh, well, of course they'd lose. You know, like, but I think this movie is a great lesson in that, like, yeah, like, some, if you've got a story and you're getting toward the end and you're like, I have to make my character achieve their goal because that's like what people want. And it's like, you know, sometimes you don't. Sometimes there's more power in making them lose, you know, like if they wouldn't win, then they shouldn't win. So I don't know.
I would say in really base terms, the victory is being friends and being cool.
Yeah. No,
like, you know what I mean? Like, it's so much more important in this movie for them to get their dignity back and all, like, work together and be friends. You know, like, that's.
And it made me think of Jamie's three arcs, which is, correct me if I'm getting them wrong, Jamie, the basics, the learns to care more. Learns to believe in themselves, like, gains confidence, and learns to work as a team. Those are the three, right, Jamie?
Yep, that's right.
Yep, and that's
what I meant. I just said it in my crappy terms.
That's what the team lost this championship, but they all three of those things I feel like are measurable for the entire team, right? Everybody cares more, everybody believes in themselves, and they all like came together. So
there's the power of failure. You're talking about the failure of the plot versus the, I'm just for other people, like, there's the plot winning and then there's the character winning. Rocky achieves his personal goal.
Yeah.
And
he fails at the plot of the movie.
The plot of the movie. Yeah. But it doesn't fucking matter.
It's the same thing with Rocky. Is I feel like if Rocky had won that fight, it might not have felt authentic, you know, and it might not have rang true the way that him, you know, not winning. You know,
it might actually take away from.
That's what I mean. Yeah, yes, yeah, yeah. Yes. And if and that you have to weigh that when you're writing. Am I going to make the 90s? And that to compare the two, like the 90s, like the Mighty Ducks, like they won, you know, they win the championship. And there is a little bit level of like inauthenticity to it all, like compared to the, you know, when you first, the story shows them within like a few games becoming like the greatest hockey kid, well, hockey players of all time.
It's the sequel. Yeah.
They're, right. They're the Olympic team.
The Olympic team.
You guys,
God, I love it.
You guys remind me of a couple things that I thought of when I was watching it. So first of all, I think in TV tropes, there's a trope called second places for winners. And that's what this is what they call it.
Oh, there you go.
It's weird. I don't know if it's good. Like TV tropes always kind of gets me because in some ways there's a fine line between TV tropes and screenwriting instruction. Like there really is a fine line. Like a lot of the same things I would say are TV tropes, you know, they just put a label on something. But they're so common that they're worth observing and seeing how they fit into your story that falls into mm-hmm. one of these genres. But anyway, the outside the box thing I wanted to say about this when I watched this is they do playing baseball with kids in a bad way so good that I have to think they really just kind of play, they like hit balls at them and they were like, try to field this. And they couldn't because they don't really feel staged. They just feel like kids. There's just something about how bad the kids are at playing baseball that it seems, I'd almost like to see the making of it. Cause it really does feel like when you just take some kids out there that really don't know what they're doing and you start hitting balls at them kind of hard and they're just like, ah, and they're like, you know, they can't really figure it out. Like, anyway, it sort of fascinated me when I was watching. I was like, this baseball doesn't
also
look staged.
That really helps with like how the Yankees, how Vic Moreau as the Yankees coach goes down, because like for kids to be good, you have to be kind of an asshole, militant, you know, coach.
Right.
You know
right,
what I mean? Like yeah. the only way to get kids
that
to action,
level of
that level
of
performance.
Yeah.
yeah. You'd have to be this yeah. asshole, you know, like, you can't just have normal kids under a normal regimen there. they have to be pushed hard.
But Jamie, I cut you off on the respect moment.
Oh, yes. So, yeah, sorry. So one other moment, and again, I'm sure there's a TV trope for this too. but there's always this kind of moment of respect at the end of these. So this is like Drago or whatever, you know, coming up at the end or when all the Russians start chanting Rocky's name or something,
right,
you know
right,
what I mean?
Right, right.
It's like
yeah.
they've turned the crowd. Karate Kid, you know, after yeah. he wins, they kind of come up to him and they're like, you know, I can't remember what they say. I don't remember their quote, but there's a moment of respect from the enemy. And this movie, what I love has it. But again, it subverts it. So the kid's like, you played a real good game. We don't think you're really that good or anything, but you know, and it's kind of hilarious because it does yeah. a moment of respect, but the kids are still, the Yankees are still jerks, right?
They're not wrong.
Yeah.
The Yankees
yeah.
are actually kind of right. They're not good at baseball. The Bad News Bears aren't that good.
Yeah. So it's kind of, I love that. We still don't think y'all are that good at baseball team, you know, and I'm just like, that is so good, you know, because
it's so condescending.
Yeah, it's the moment now where, again, I don't know if it happens in Mighty Ducks, but I imagine they were like, you know, they're like shaking their head. They give them hot.
The
you
Hawks.
Know,
the
Hawks respect the Mighty Ducks. There's not in this
usually
movie.
You usually get like the abused kids kind of like recognizing that the other team wasn't actually the villains, that the evil coach.
Right.
In the 90s, that was what it was.
Yeah.
Right? Like
yeah.
they recognized
the toxic
their coaches.
Masculinity is.
Yeah. Like, oh, wait, they're actually all friends and their coach like, loves them. And you know,
like
I recognize
said,
that.
Whether it's Apollo hugging Rocky at the end or whatever, most movies do have the opponent
yeah, respect. Yeah.
Kind of finally has the respect. Like, you know, you beat me and, you know, I know you're. You could stand toe to toe. We're equals now. This movie has it and then subverts it, which is just. but that's what I mean.
We don't want your respect. Eat shit. You know.
Right.
Like, yeah.
And then I love how Lupus throws the trophy at him. Like he literally throws the trophy at the kid and hits him. I mean, that's, it's like the best, you know. So it's just, it just does a really good job of subverting all those things. It just takes, and that's why, I mean, like TV tropes, you can take them and subvert them. You could say, okay, I'm going to do all these things in that a normal movie would have, but then I'm going to kind of give them the middle finger in my script, you know, or something
That.
And tropes are your friend for sure as a writer.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's just how you enact them, right?
Yep.
The next one I think is a great place. Also, Comic Obsessions is also a great place to talk about. This movie is so of its time. like I know exactly what you're gonna. This is, I'm assuming this is Jimmy. Is this Jimmy?
I chose the like really saccharine ones.
Oh, but there's some Comic Obsessions here that are so of 1976. Yeah,
you can list them after me.
Well, I don't know if I want to list one of them, but yeah.
So this is in case you haven't listened to our other 114 episodes.
Yeah.
This is a technique that I learned from Robert McKee's comedy seminar, and it's the idea that a way to create a comedy engine for your character is to give them this obsession, this fixation, this extreme behavior that they deem is like normal, and then the audience and everyone else around them deems as extreme. So like some of the examples we've used on other episodes is Meg Ryan, Sally's complicated restaurant orders in When Harry Met Sally. Randy's, speaking of tropes, Randy's encyclopedic horror movie knowledge in Scream. Ian Malcolm's chaos theory in Jurassic Park, right? Like every single scene, the reason that he's funny is because he's talking about the chaos theory. Recently, we did Paul's obsession with historical references in Holdovers. Mm-hmm. And I loved that this movie is 48 years old and we're still seeing all the way back then, all this stuff tracks. We got Comic Obsessions. Two right off the top of my head, which I don't think are going to be the ones you're going to say, Bob, are Ogilvy and his baseball trivia and his baseball statistics. Like he knows everything about, you know, his career, the guy's career. He knows everything about every single statistic of every single player on the team. He knows all the statistics of the other players on the other teams. And every time he's funny, it's because of that. And then Tanner, the little short temper kid. I mean, I love that. Like one of the first thing he does is try to beat up Butter, like Buttermaker. Yeah. He tries to punch Buttermaker right off the top. Every time that like somebody pisses him off, he literally tries to start a fist fight with them. So those were two right off the top. What are the ones you were going to say, Bob?
Oh, I was thinking of, I mean, just straight up something you would not see today is Engelberg. Is that the name?
Yeah,
the fat kid. Yeah. The fat kid's obsession with food.
Right, like why is there chocolate on this ball? And like, is it it's like the kind of jokes. It's the you know, I'm glad we don't see things like that because it's like the writers making fun of the character as opposed. You know, it's one thing if characters. Or horrible.
The characters are not. This is a whole movie of unvirtuous characters.
Yeah,
there's nothing. They're not supposed to be role models of any sort.
Those particular obsessions. The reason I especially don't like them is the writer making fun of the characters, not the characters making fun of the characters. I'm okay actually with mean spirited sometimes if it shows how much of a jerk the character is. You know. But in this case, it's just showing kind of the writers like making a cheap shot on somebody.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
That's the one. It's of its time and whatever.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff.
I would also say you could argue that Tanner's racism is a repeated.
Oh, yeah.
That's definitely not happening today.
Xenophobia. There's racism. There's homophobia.
That. But he says it like three times. It repeats.
Yeah.
So we're gonna talk about that. But that's a comic obsession. His like obsession with like how the fact that the team isn't all white men is like actually the thing that he's obsessed with.
Right.
So yeah. And then, there's just some stuff. I mean, it's of its time.
I would say
even
like
the alcohol could even be considered a comic obsession.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
Walter Matthau has a beer every scene, right?
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, yeah.
I would say
not just as a beer, he's icing the players' arms with the
in buckets of beer, giving kids beer. It's like, yeah, his whole life is drinking. So
I would say like Amanda Wurlitzer, like she has an obsession almost with being an adult in some ways. Like she's herself as like more sophisticated than a child and stuff like that. She's a great character. Like every 4, 5, 6 year old boy, like that was their first crush until Princess Leia showed up a year later. She was the one. Like she was the coolest girl ever, you know, at that time. But
it looks like the marketing really leaned on her as second lead, right? Like she was.
It did. I think I read something like they gave her $350,000 and back end to be in the movie because she was coming off. Yeah, she was coming off Paper Moon. And
okay.
And they, so you know, she was actually like one of their big gets for the movie.
The kid stars. Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
I think she was the only one, you know, the only known presence besides Walter Matthau and Vic Morrow. But R.I.P. I don't know. Yeah.
To all of them.
Yeah. Yep.
Like whenever I, it's sad that whenever I see Vic Morrow, I think of, you know what, the Twilight Zone.
Yeah. I mean, that's about all, you know, that it's so weighs so heavily. And in fact,
it weighs so heavily. He's a great actor. It's just, yeah. It's just,
I forgot it was him in this. That's how much it. Kind
oh, really?
The tragedy overshadows. Yeah. I'm like, they're probably the two movies I know him most for, to be honest.
Yeah. Yeah.
In my lifetime. But yeah, because my wife was like, who was that? I'm like, that's a, I forgot actually. I was like, oh, I think and then I realized it was Vic Morrow, and then I had to explain to her who Vic Morrow was. But yeah, he was good.
Google that. Really, anyone listening can Google it for themselves.
He's really good in this.
He's
really good in it.
Yeah. Well, that leads us right into repetition, right?
Yeah. This
like,
is
totally.
Yeah. With the sports movies, especially. So, this is one I even just talked about it on Aliens, and I'll reference that one in a minute. But, you know, a very simple way to help the audience track how a character is progressing or regressing is to show us the same scenario multiple times. And sometimes it's not a scenario that's the specifically scenario. Sometimes it's a piece of dialogue like, may the force be with you. My name is Inigo Montoya from Princess Bride. And most recently we did in Aliens, Ripley putting Newt to bed. The first time she does it, we know that Ripley is haunted by nightmares, and then Newt tells her that she's haunted by nightmares, and she says, you know, we'll go to sleep, but don't dream. And then in the end, when they go into cryo sleep, she says, go to sleep. And she says, can we dream now? And Ripley says, I think we both can. So just to show how the relationship is progressing, and also how the characters are progressing in the story, repetition is just a very powerful technique to do that. And in sports movies in particular, it's like the purest form, right? Like showing a character who's not good at something, then like show them do the same thing and get better at it. It's like very easy to learn from, like, this is what you can do. Like, now pop a different genre on this, and that's how you can like do the same thing in your movie. So like, there's a bunch of great, simple to learn from examples in this movie. The 2, 4, 6, 8, who do we appreciate chant. It's first chanted the first time that the Bears get their asses kicked, and it their faces, all the Bears look so sad when they hear that chant. And then the first time that they get to do it is when the White Sox have to forfeit because they can't they don't have enough players, which happened a lot when I was growing up, by the way.
Absolutely. It happened to me too. Yeah.
When I saw that scene, I was like, oh my God, like there's so, you just unlocked the tidal wave of memories of games where
Jimmy,
like,
I was on the team that would have to forfeit.
You're like, come on, man.
Yeah.
Put my dad on second base. So then the 2, 4, 6, 8 later is reversed again, where at the championship, they lose, and we hear the Yankees chant it again, like we first heard the Yankees chant. And this time, when we see all of the Bears, they're changed, right? It's that chant doesn't make them sad. We get the sense that they have their dignity, like you said, Bob.
Right.
So the writing, the story uses that chant to show us how the Bears are progressing over the course of the story. So I thought that was good. We haven't really heard like a chant repetition before. Some other easy ones to learn from is the center fielder can't catch the ball because of the sun. And so they get him sunglasses and we see the same thing again. And the center fielder, Ahmad, he catches the ball because he's got sunglasses, you know. But there you go. He's getting better. They use the same scenario. And then my favorite one is the shortstop can't catch the ball because the field's shitty. Another thing I love about this movie, by the way, every single we are in, for those who are out there listening, we are from Baltimore, and every field around here is a piece of shit.
Oh, God.
And like the number of times a ball hit a rock and then hit me in the face because it was coming straight at me and it just hit a rock on the dirt because it was like you're playing in mud. And I just loved how the fields in these movies are so shitty. Like, it's so great. And so, like, they got to get on their
knees. They were worse than ours in some way.
They were. Yeah. So they got to get on their knees to – the shortstop can't catch – really, none of them can catch the ground balls. But the short – he's like, you got to get on your knees. So he teaches them. We see the coach do the ground ball drill. And then we see a game, and the kid gets on his knees, and he catches the ground ball. And you're like, yay! But this is like – it's so simple to learn from. And even though, yeah, it's a sports movie, that's the kind of thing you need to do in your story to show us very easily and help us measure how your character is getting better. Or it could go the opposite way and how the kid, you give us the same scenario twice, three times, four times, however long it takes. So yeah, it was just,
no,
I was, great. I love that a 48 year old movie was doing this, you know?
No, absolutely. That's actually, we already covered the power of failures. That's actually, we did. This is a short. This movie is gloriously simple. Like, mm-hmm. I think that's the, like, you, like, some of our listeners might be like, that was all your topics, but like, this movie is so meat and potato simple.
Yeah, I thought about tracking Buttermaker's growing pains because, like, I think there's a really good there's a lot of great examples of Jamie's idea of before and after snapshots. Like, each character has a very distinct before snapshot that's like the old way is the wrong way. And then we see growing pains along the way, and they have a very distinct after snapshot that's kind of like a bookend of the way we met them. You know, like Buttermaker, at the first Bears game, he doesn't even argue for them or defend them. He's like, let's just forfeit the game. And then the last game, he's literally like stepping on the field in the umpire's face, defending their honor and being like, are you kidding me? You know what
I mean? Also, he's also arguing with the guy who funded the team that the worst players should get a chance.
Yeah.
Like, he's actually arguing for the kids. Every child in my team plays.
Yeah.
Which he would have never done at the beginning of the movie, right?
So it's just
It's also like a good, this movie's awesome because, like, he's not trying to, in the end, he's not trying to retain or find his glory again on the field. Like, that's not what it's about. It's like, he just learns to not be an asshole.
Like, he learns to care more, right?
He learns to care more. That's like it. Like, he's not trying to, the glory is not the point.
Well,
because he obviously had glory once in his life, right?
Right.
Like, he was yeah.
But he kind of gets into it for money. He's never. I mean, he's kind of grumpy, but never horrible to the kids. In some ways,
no, he doesn't beat them or anything.
It's kind of nice, though. But then as he goes through, the winning gets to him, and he wants to win for them almost. But then he realizes at the end what a real win is for them.
Yeah.
There's also, I mean, another, in some ways, incredible scene when I watch this movie. You know, I love that dugout scene that we talked about. The other one that always gets me is when he throws beer in Amanda's face. And there's that relationship. It's just like, you know, without seeing her mother, like, I'm half tempted. I don't remember the Billy Bob Thornton movie. I just have a feeling we see her mother in the Billy Bob Thornton.
I should have rewatched it. Sure. Sorry, I should have done that.
Yeah,
I'm gonna
rewatch it like tonight probably.
But the fact that his relationship with her is just about her is kind of incredible. Like, it has, you know, it has the B story kind of relationship story with her,
and she's the adult in the room.
She's the adult
in this whole movie. She's the adult in the room.
I'm still questionable about her injuries, why she was in a sling and then she got hit in the chest and her arm hurt. And, you know, I'm a little skeptical about her injuries, but
I mean, pitcher's elbow is a real thing that happens, right?
Pitcher's elbow is a real thing for sure.
It is a real thing.
Tommy John surgery.
That was a great example, Jamie, of what I was saying was how he would go. He had a lot of step backwards before he had his moment of grace there when he was yelling at them in that great moment that you're talking about. He takes a lot of steps back before he takes a step forward, and I love that. Forward. And I think it's really instructive.
Yeah.
Before we get into the listener's question, I just want to give this pitch for the 2025 remake of Bad News Bears. I think, Jamie, this might be more up your alley than Jimmy, but...
Okay.
Once Righteous Gemstones is over.
Uh-oh. Yeah, yeah. I know where you're going.
Danny McBride as Buttermaker and Walton Goggins as the Yankees coach. Series on HBO. Come on.
Yeah.
One season, just one season.
I think it works. Man.
I think it works, right? Walton Goggins. Danny McBride as Buttermaker is pretty great. You got to admit.
Oh, absolutely.
Danny McBride could do this.
I think it could be a Kenny Powers sequel.
You could just have Kenny
Powers show up and coach the – yeah, I think Kenny Powers could totally be it.
I don't know. Here's the problem with that, though, is I don't want him to learn. I like Kenny Powers not learning. You know, he kind of does at the end of the show, but it'd be really hard to have him not learn anything.
But that's the weird thing about Kenny Powers. Like, he can learn that – The interesting thing about a Kenny Powers character is he can learn that winning isn't everything.
Yeah,
he still is so full of himself when he
learns. Yeah, he still thinks he's the greatest.
Yeah, right. He's like, still consistent.
That's the interesting thing about that character is he does learn, but he still has so much to learn. You know what I mean?
It's great how relevant Eastbound and Down is to this podcast.
I mean, that show is like in my top five of all time. So I'm a big fan of that. But watching this, I was like, if it wasn't Billy Bob, it'd have to be Danny McBride. Like, it just have to be Danny McBride, right? I don't want them to remake it, but if those guys and that team did it for an HBO series, I'm fucking in. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. I totally watch it.
Yeah. Absolutely.
That's the greatest pitch ever.
Yes. I did it. Okay. We got a listener's question.
Listener question.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm going to read it. And it's kind of a lengthy question.
It's less a question and more a pitch of a technique.
But
I like that they sent
it's from the Silver Screen Happy Hour podcast, guys. Jerome specifically, that's a good podcast. I've listened to it. So I'm just going to say at the top, check out their show. They have actually plugged us on their show. So, awesome. Number one, thank you. And check out their show, Silver Screen Happy Hour. Okay. Hey guys, just listen to the Aliens episode. I love the Catalyst discussion because, quite frankly, I've gone back and forth on inciting incidents, double bumps, debates, the whole gamut over the years, and I love hearing differing perspectives. I've seen a lot of films that mostly might have one catalyst with little debate. Examples are Raiders of the Lost Ark, which obviously works, and I love it. Or something like Norma Rae, where the debate happens as late as the midpoint. Lately, I found that I gravitate more to what I call the 4-point push, where actually all the elements are included, preferably in the first 25 pages. So it's number one would be the inciting incident. First hint, the before world is about to change. Number two would be the catalyst. The big thing that happens that crashes into the before world. Number three would be debate begins. Will they? Won't they? Number four is the double bump. Another thing happens that forces the hero to decide to go into the new world. So essentially, I found it works better when you have all of these, including the double bump every time. The Aliens 4-point push. The inciting incident, part one. Ripley is rescued and thus the knowledge of where the aliens are. Catalyst, part two. We lost contact with the colony. debate begins, part three. I said no, and I mean it. I'm not going back, and I wouldn't be any good if I did. The double bump, part four. The nightmare driving the motivation for closure. Then he gave us this is the Star Wars 4-point push. The inciting incident.
Wait, are you saying, are you calling it the Star Wars now?
Yes, yes.
The Star Wars.
That's what we're calling it now in 24, Jamie.
Okay.
Star Wars 4-point push. Inciting incident part one. Luke meets the droids. Catalyst part two. Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope. Debate begins part three. I can't get involved. I got work to do. Double bump part four. Uncle Owen and Aunt Beru charboiled. What do you think? Anyways, great podcast. Love your show.
Yeah, Jamie, you that's had a lot to digest. Say about that. But
well,
yeah.
So I think all of this kind of stuff is in the eye of the beholder, and I think these are all very valuable breakdowns. I don't think there's anything wrong about these for sure. The only thing I would say is the way, and this is more me saying, here's how save the cat, or how I teach save the cat. It's less like saying this is wrong, because there's no wrong or right.
Yeah.
Like if you want to think about it as a four, in fact, this 4-point push really speaks to what we talked about with the catalyst today with Buttermaker, because in some ways you could say his inciting incident was getting hired for the team. Then the catalyst is the thing I said, so on and so forth. So it kind of actually works for.
Yeah, you could probably track the 4-point push for Bad News Bears.
I think you could. I think you could.
Yeah.
Using this 4-point push. Yeah.
My only thing is the way he's categorizing double bump is different than the way I categorize it.
And I think the way that we've both talked about it in our other podcast, not to confuse the way that we talk about it.
Right. Because the double bump that he's listed here, like Uncle Owen and Aunt Beru are charbroiled, or the nightmare driving motivation for closure. That's actually the way I teach it, the break into two. The break into two has a thing that happens, like the nightmare. Like if I was doing a Aliens Save the Cat, that would be my break into two. But the way I teach, because just to avoid confusion for break into two, is it's a thing that happens that causes an action to be taken. Okay. So sometimes I include both in the same beat. Like when I look at break into two, even though it's sometimes categorized as a single beat, to me, when Luke sees Uncle Owen and Aunt Beru, in his heart, the decision is made to go on the quest. And we know that. So then therefore the thing happens. In Aliens, the nightmare happens and then she makes a call, I'm in, or whatever she says. I kind of combine both into the break into two. But I feel both are necessary for break into two. I feel like if you don't have a thing like the nightmare or Uncle Owen and Aunt Beru, it's kind of a fizzle of a debate. You know, it's just like, and then they get
isn't
over
this
it,
you know. What Crystal Skull was lacking, the double bump? Isn't that, I feel like that was very specifically what
even we, more than that.
It was.
Remember we talked about the debate? It was like five different scenes.
And we couldn't even
explain.
We couldn't understand.
I know. Yeah. I guess, but they sort of very badly.
Something happens. With
they badly
crystal.
Gave us a catalyst, but
you're
they
right.
never gave us the second one. That's why we're all like, what? Why? Like,
you're right. It was very loose. Like, come help the guy you might have known a long time ago.
Right.
He just kind of went like there was
there's no double bump or there's no break into two as
it's
you
just
guys
kind of
call
like
it.
Yeah. So
I hate to keep beating up on Crystal Skull, but
and the only other thing I'd say is, you know, using the inciting incident and the catalyst, what I usually lump together, and it's fine if you know
and that's what I do too, yeah, Jamie.
But
yeah.
So the only thing is something like I think the cool thing he says here is Luke meets the droids and help me Obi-Wan. Like that is kind of a double bump in some ways. There is two parts to that. So I think that's a double bump catalyst. However, with Aliens, I think Ripley being rescued is more to the prologue that sets up the ordinary world. I don't know. I mean, yes, you could argue that it sets up the knowledge, but she already knows where the aliens are. And I think it's, you know, stories do sometimes have prologues. So the ordinary world is her being back and you know, figuring out the world and the world kind of trying to blame her for the thing and her being haunted by nightmares and all that stuff. And then the catalyst, we lost contact with the colony, shows up. I don't really see that as a double bump the same way.
Yeah, and that's funny, not to confuse it even worse, but we had that debate last episode, Jamie, because I did see it as two catalysts.
You did.
Oh, yeah, you did.
And I even found, I think they both were on your list that you made codifying the different types of, like, life sucks. You've been awakened, and everybody in your life is dead because you've been asleep for 74 years.
Right.
Like,
right.
I think one of your catalysts is life sucks.
Yeah. And I feel like the inciting incident there, and something I'm a big proponent of, is story before the story.
Mm-hmm. It's a good point.
Because while she's rescued, that doesn't really... Here's where my mind feels differently. Where I feel like that's story before the story. That's bringing her into a new world, what she's then trying to do and blah, blah, blah. However, it doesn't... Her being rescued doesn't really push us toward her going back. It's kind of strange, but when you look at it, her being rescued
doesn't automatically mean that they lost the colony.
They're like two random events, in my opinion. It's just Ripley's now back in the equation, I think. Her being rescued isn't what caused them to build the colony. The colony's been built a long time ago and was already in the motion to lose contact with the colony. So to me, they don't really fit. Like, where this, the better argument for this in my head is like Jaws, when the attack happens in that first scene, you could say that's the inciting incident or catalyst. Or is it when Brody finds out about the attack? I could almost see you going in that direction as a better example of this kind of 4-point push, where
not to bring in the last episode too much, but you could also talk about like Lost World or Jurassic Park 3.
Yeah.
What's the inciting incident in those, right? Is it the thing that happens before the movie?
Right.
You know? Or actually, yeah. Jurassic Park 3, it happens in the movie. You see it. Yeah, you actually see the inciting incident, I guess, right? The kid and his stepdad.
You do.
Yeah.
Anyway, I really like this question. I like this technique. I think it's interesting.
There's nothing wrong with this technique.
I like ideas. Yeah. I am really into as many tools as possible, whatever gets you there, right?
Yeah.
If it helps you write, do it.
Yeah.
Do your 4-point push.
So thanks, Jerome. And I want more questions. I love hearing these things. So yeah.
Ask good questions. They got to get by the Jimmy filter. Jimmy's the filter.
What's so funny is sometimes recently people have been answering questions that I can like asking questions I can answer like right away. They're so like, oh yeah, let me answer this. They're like, I don't need Bob and Jamie for this.
Yeah. Probably most things you can probably do.
I like this one because it honestly is one that it makes a lot of sense. It is an interesting way to look at it, and I think it works. Again, there's no right or wrong. I'm more explaining my.
Yeah, I wanted to hear your take on it in contrast.
That's saying this is wrong because it's
no,
more
I,
like,
I definitely yeah. was looking to hear your take based on like the terms that you use and how you teach them.
Yeah,
so,
also in a world of these terms which you guys live in, 4-point push sounds good.
Yeah, it does.
It really sounds good, like from a marketing perspective. You're gonna want that 4-point push in there.
It's actually a technique to help with constipation as well.
You need your hydration, your fiber.
I saw it on Reddit once when I was constipated. Yeah.
If you have questions about the Bad News Bears episode, about previous episodes, email us at writersblockbusterspodcast@gmail.com.
And as we said, if you just want to ask us questions, that's fine too. We're not guaranteeing we're going to answer them, but if you ask us enough questions, we might do a question episode.
I want it. I think that would be so fun.
If you want to know what Jamie's, favorite 90s sports movie actually is. You know, you can ask that.
If you want Jamie to list movies for 10.
Yeah, if you want 90 minutes of Jamie listing movies, which is the true, which will be the most happy he'll ever have been in his life.
I just want a podcast of that where we just go through.
We just go through top 10.
We just talk about like 1976's box office, and that's all we do. Yeah,
that's not a bad podcast idea. Yeah, honestly, like it's not a terrible idea.
We'd probably only get about 30 shows out of it because we'd run out of years.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, no,
we'd be like the 1927 box office top 12. I'd have to watch all those movies.
Yeah. Well, you could also talk all the way up till now, and that'd be really weird too, right? Mm-hmm. Gosh, one whole decade of like Marvel and Harry Potter and all that stuff. It'd be terribly boring to talk about those years.
Yeah, like, especially like last year or this year. It would be, oof.
I don't even know what that would be. I don't even know what the top 10 would be of like last year. Well, Oppenheimer and Barbie, but
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Probably a few Marvels, some animated things I didn't see, you know, something else.
I don't know. Box office is so weird now. It doesn't.
Fast and the Furious would be there every year, probably.
Yeah.
There will always be a Fast and the Furious.
Yeah.
Even when they underperform, they'd still be in the top 10.
It'd still be in the top 10. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's everything, right? Yeah. I'm so used to us cutting it off, you know, in a nick of time for Jamie. Yeah. like, I don't know what to do when we have time to talk. How do I end the show when we have time? Okay. Yeah. Send us questions. Do you guys have anything left that you want to plug?
I will say two things. Two movies I made a while back just came out on Blu-ray, so I might as well talk about them. A slasher movie that made in like 2009 for like $5,000 called President's Day is out at Terrorvision. Look it up if you want to see a $5,000 budget slasher movie. And then I'm another movie I made that Bob helped out with. Bob was a part of What Happens Next Will Scare You. We made it a couple of years ago, and it's a found footage clickbait horror anthology. There you go. Check that out.
Check those out. Jamie, anything?
Black Velvet Fairies is an audio drama supernatural thriller that's now out there wherever you find podcasts. It's on about episode 6, something like that. It's got 13 episodes. So jump in now. You could check it out.
I'm in episode 1, so there you go.
Hell yeah.
Episode 1. Everybody gave up after episode 1 cuz
Bob left. Yeah. Cuz Bob was gone.
Yeah, you didn't get that bump. You didn't get the bump.
No. Nope.
Yeah. I think that's everything though, guys. Just send us questions and you know, hire Jimmy, watch Jamie. One Night at Terrace Lanes is on Apple TV, right?
Get it right, dude. Last night.
Sorry. Yep. Sorry. I got the fucking title wrong. No, wait, sorry.
One Night is the prequel.
Yeah. And then the sequel is Late Night at Terrace Lanes.
It should be
Late Night with the Devil at Terrace Lanes. Is what
right.
It's called.
We are just so silly right now.
Yeah, well, we just have all this time. We don't know what to do with it. That's everything, I think. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.
Thanks for listening.
Bye.
Hey, this is Bob Rose, and thank you for listening to Writer's Blockbusters. If you'd like to financially support the show, please consider joining my Patreon. I've been producing the podcast for several years completely out of pocket, and I'd like to keep producing it ad-free and no longer at a loss. If you'd like to help, head on over to patreon.com/BobRoseSucks. That's right. Bob Rose sucks. And if you want the one and only Jimmy George to help polish up that writing project you're kind of struggling with, head on over to scriptbutcher.com. As a listener, you already know he's the best there is. Scriptbutcher.com. You can also support the show by simply sharing it or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate both. Thank you for listening and see you next episode.